This is the Parliament Hillbillies, episode 4, for March 13th, 2006.
Mr. Speaker, I don't know what the honourable member has been smoking or taking. The fact is...
Welcome to the Parliament Hillbillies, your podcast for Canadian politics. I'm Alex.
And as always, I'm Jeremy. You can check us out on our blog if you haven't found it yet. It's at phbo.blogspot.com. If you have any comments about today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Just leave them on the blog. You can find our email address listed there as well.
Well, today on the show, we're going to be talking about Prime Minister Harper and his surprise trip to Afghanistan. The Ethics Commissioner, Bernard Shapiro. What about Belinda? What about Scott Bryson? And of course, Emerson's in deep doo-doo, literally. Peter Cormos, the NDP MPP from Ontario, on the topic of organ donation. And we're leaving off with a sort of more worldly topic of Iran's nuclear program and the current state of affairs there.
Right. So anyway, to start off, I guess we'll look at Stephen Harper. Prime Minister Harper made a surprise visit, very, you know, sort of a George Bush type of thing to do. Just shows up unannounced in Afghanistan.
So the news on that, okay, broke last night. So Sunday evening. I guess what happened was Friday, they gave a select few media the scoop on it, on the condition that they wouldn't report on it until Sunday evening. So then he flies to Eastern Europe, transfers over into a an Airbus, flies to Pakistan, and then transfers into the rockin' Canadian military Hercules transport plane, flies into the Kandahar base the Canadians have there, and met with the troops and even spent the night.
Well, at least he got a flight in on the Airbus. I don't think Gordon O'Connor would have it any other way.
Yeah,
he went along with him as well.
Gordon O'Connor's there, and they met up with General Rick Hillier, and saw the troops, met everyone, and it was kind of a funny story because he chose to spend the night, which is kind of unprecedented. Most leaders are usually in and out in a matter of hours, and they don't actually spend the night there. So, it is a little bit dangerous there still. And they were saying that the Canadian base has come under rocket attack. And I guess the rocket attacks have died down recently, but right up until Christmas, they were coming under rocket attack, every few days. And by that, I mean, jerk Taliban forces, I guess, are hiding out in the hills, and they have these long-range rockets, and they're kind of pummeling the base. And so, there was a need for the visit to be kind of secretive, because they didn't want to let anyone know, to give them time to prepare an attack. And so what happened was, Harper got to sleep in this kind of little metal, tool shed kind of thing, and they were saying about how, they keep the flak jacket and the helmet beside his bed. And they were prepping him on, if there was a rocket attack in the middle of the night, they were going to have to rush in and, haul him out and get him into, into a bunker and into safety. But, he'd have to be ready for it because, he'd be disoriented and confused, on the other side of the world, and it's all dark and there's all these bombs going off around him. But it seems anyway like that didn't happen. So, we're thankful. And
Yeah, you probably didn't get a very good night's sleep. I'm not sure.
Well, I mean, anytime you're doing such a big travel, you never get,
True.
International travel, you always never get a good night's sleep, so.
Right. So I understand that this is the first visit that the Canadian Prime Minister has made to Afghanistan since Jean Chrétien. Of course, Paul Martin didn't go over to Afghanistan.
To our knowledge anyway, so.
Yeah.
Which, is kind of, I think, significant. And, from a PR standpoint, it was really, I think, a really good move on his part. On Prime Minister Harper's part to go, especially with a lot of smack talk in the media lately about Canada's role in Afghanistan. A lot of the NDP pressure to hold a debate on the topic, and basically Harper has come out and said, the time for debate is long past. We won't have any debate while our troops are manning the mission. Now, I guess that comes up for review in the summer, and that they would, I think, have their leadership transferred over to another international body, another country, for example. And then, I think it was August or whatever that's going to happen. And then, we can talk about the the role of Canada in Afghanistan then. But in the meantime, everybody should just shut up and, you know, support the troops, you know, because what are you really going to do, you know? I mean, these people are, you know, defending our interests there. And I think that, you know, you can debate about Iraq and the role of the United States in Iraq and, you know, about whether or not Canada should have gone. You know, that's all well and good to debate. But I think that, you know, well, anyway, I hope that most people would at least recognize the value of the Afghanistan mission. So.
Right. I don't know. I don't see this, like, support the troops as mutually exclusive from not debating about the war. I think, you know, the troops' morale, I mean, I'm sure if they're facing danger in Kandahar, they can handle, you know, the knowledge that people back home are debating the policy. But
there's a time and a place. I mean, the thing is, the commitment has been made, and so, you know, we must now, you know, follow out that commitment. It's only going to be until the summer, you know, and sort of like in the interim, you know, we just need to have, you know, the troops just need to know that, you know, Canada, their country, you know, their home, that they're, you know, being supported and that, you know.
Right. Yeah, I agree with that. I certainly support our initiative in Afghanistan. I'm a bit fearful that this sort of fierce patriotism that, you know, we see in definitely in the United States, where you just can't question anything, you can't say anything. You know, it's basically a form of political correctness, but it's, you know, the right's form of political correctness.
But on the other hand, I sometimes feel that, you know, Canada suffers from a, you know, almost the extreme opposite of the, you know, the Americans have, you know, a bit of a problem, you know, cultural problem with, like, you know, patriotism, you know, hardcore. But at the same time, you know, Canada, I think, has a, you know, startling lack of patriotism, you know. So, I mean, I think a little bit of, you know, stand up for the country is okay, you know, and I'd like to see a little bit more of that in Canada. I mean, you know, not as maybe as much as the United States, okay, but, you know,
right,
patriotism where it's due, and I think that it's due, you know, on this particular matter, so.
Yeah, I'm certainly in agreement there, and I'm very glad that, you know, Prime Minister Harper made the trip.
I mean, since you know, he's taken office, you know, the troops in Afghanistan have kind of come to the forefront, and, you know, they're sort of, their needs are being discussed, you know, the things like, you know, General Rick Hillier's suggestion of getting the Tim Hortons out there, which I think was, you know, great, you know, and they finally, you know, the soldiers can get their Timmies, you know, between, yeah, you know,
from
patrols.
A trailer,
from a trailer, but
the,
I mean,
the
thing is,
version,
you know,
well, no, that's as good as you can do under the circumstances.
I mean, anybody that's lived abroad knows about the feeling of homesickness. I think that, you know, anyone that's lived, you know, away from home knows that the concept of homesickness is, you know, is a real thing, and, you know, morale is also a real thing that can affect your, you know, your ability to do your job. And so, you know, little things like, you know, like Tim Hortons can really make all the difference in the soldiers' morale and their ability to do a good job, you know. So,
right.
So, yeah, I thought that was pretty funny, like, you know, with him, the picture of Harper, like, he's flying, like, the Hercules and stuff. And that was in the newspaper today.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of people in the media, you know, a lot of the, you know, kind of, like,
media elite.
Yeah, the media elite. I don't know. The like, vocal media elite. You know, have been complaining a lot about how Harper hasn't been accessible for, you know, photo ops and you know, whatnot. I mean, Paul Martin really raised the bar as far as, like, accessibility for media goes. You know, like, going on, like, the Rick Mercer Report and, like, you know, shopping at Canadian Tire with Rick Mercer and stuff like that. And, you know, so in that sense, he kind of had this, like, you know, very average Joe kind of quality. And certainly in, you know, the age of reality television, that's kind of maybe in some cases desirable. But at the same time, you know, they're saying, oh, well, Harper, you know, he's not accessible. He doesn't have that, like, kind of human side. But I just kind of, I don't know, it seems like they're just kind of, they're being hard on him for that. And that he really is, you know, he does do these sorts of things, but just kind of on his own terms, you know. So, like, yeah, he probably doesn't want to go shopping at Canadian Tire with Rick Mercer. But, you know, he was on the Rick Mercer Report back in November. And they were spoofing the Nike ad, you know, the one with Jerome Iginla, and he's, you know, running through the streets and all these hockey pucks are, like, shooting around him, and then he, like, finally gets to the rooftop and there's, like, the guy that's, like, shooting the pucks, and he kind of kicks over the bucket full of, like, pucks and stuff. And but then, like, Rick Mercer and Harper did that, and then it's like Harper was the one shooting the, you know. So
yeah,
the
Rick
thing is,
Mercer's running through the streets, and then he climbs up on the roof.
I mean, like, you know, Harper's a big hockey fan, so, I mean, that's the sort of thing that he could be, you know, he could get on board with. But the point is that, you know, okay.
Yeah, I think that, like, from a PR perspective, was better than him flipping burgers in like a leather vest and a cowboy hat.
That, I mean, I think that everyone agrees that the whole like leather vest thing was probably like, back in the summer. I mean, I think everyone in Canada's probably seen that picture by now, and it ain't pretty. So. Yeah, so like the press, you know, the media elite really has to get over their sort of like self-importance that, you know, somehow they're sort of deserving of all of this sort of stuff. I mean, I think it was, you know, nice that, you know, Paul Martin would play along, but on the other hand, I think that kind of harmed his image in a little, you know, a little bit. It kind of sort of made him not seem as serious. So the thing is, you know, what do you want your leader to be? Do you want him to be sort of like frail and human, or do you want him to be kind of, you know, like a little bit of a, like an image, you know, sort of like a figurehead kind of thing? And
yeah, I don't think one is necessarily worse than the other. They're different people. They have different styles. And
my point is that, you know,
the media has to adjust, obviously.
Yeah, but I think that in the age of reality television, the concept of having a kind of a, you know, a stately statesman, you know, for a leader hasn't worn off. You know, I mean, certainly, you know, if the year was like 1900, you know, you wouldn't have, you know, the prime ministers of the time, like, you know, showing up on you know, well, on early radio, you know, kind of,
yeah,
you know, like
I don't
in
know
sketch
that,
comedy kind of.
I don't know when that started. I know Jean Chrétien often would go on like Air Farce
and stuff like that. And I mean, the thing is, like, they were sort of, you know, little kind of brief moments. They were kind of like the wink and the nod, and then it sort of, you know, it went back to, you know, being serious sort of thing. So
right.
I mean, you know, a little wink and the nod now and then, I think, is okay. But
this is something like you would never see in the United States. Like, you never see, you know, George W. Bush go on, you know, The Daily Show and, you know, him and Jon Stewart, like, joking around.
Oh, yeah, of course. And, I mean, that's totally the difference between, you know, Canadian politicians and American politicians. I mean, I've always said that I've personally found that, you know, Canadian politicians are a lot more accessible. They're a lot more kind of, you know, human, you know. Peter McKay giving interviews in his, you know, grandpappy's garden, you know, like Anne McClellan, like, you know, shoveling your driveway in like a sweatshirt kind of thing, you know, giving interviews.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
All right. So the ethics commissioner, we have an inquiry, obviously, into David Emerson, and now we're hearing.
Oh, and Prime Minister Harper too.
Oh yeah, so. Sorry. It's technically into Prime Minister Harper. That's a good point.
Regarding David Emerson.
But it's regarding David Emerson.
And you know, like we've talked about this like already like numerous times. I mean. You know.
Yeah, there's nothing much to add. Of course, David Emerson got a nice little surprise this morning.
Yeah, yeah, we'll talk about that in a sec. But what you, I think, what you wanted to add was that that now the NDP has finally come around and started saying, okay, well, you know, if you're going to investigate Emerson, you know, you should have investigated Belinda too. And I think that, you know, everyone recognizes that, like, you know, Shapiro should have done that at the time, but, you know. That's
right.
Kind of the...
Well, I think it was a product of circumstance. I mean, he was involved...
Well, it
in
depends on who you talk
affair.
To. Because some people would say that it was, like, a product of, you know, Shapiro's incompetence.
Right.
As an ethics commissioner, so...
Yeah, but I don't know. I mean, he was, like,
that's the word on the street, man.
An investigation.
It's not
right. Well, it's easy to say in retrospect. Now, I'm not particularly opposed to having, to widening the mandate of the investigation to include floor crossings just in general. And so... You know, the ethics commissioner can certainly look at the Belinda situation. I think there's a bit of a logistics concern because it happened so long ago. And it may be that some of the people who were involved in that situation, I'm not sure, but some of them may not have been reelected. And so they might not be in parliament right now.
Yeah, but actually, as you were saying before, you know, when we were preparing for the show before we started recording, you know, the point was that all of a sudden the NDP a year later is saying, hey, you know, you should investigate Belinda. Then you got the Liberals, you know, sort of saying, you know, Emerson should be, you know, pounded on, but they're making no mention of Belinda.
Yeah, actually, they specifically asked about Belinda and they said, oh no, don't investigate her. Like,
yeah, and then you have the Conservatives saying, you know, don't bother to investigate Emerson. That's like, you know, it's a waste of time. So you basically have everyone sort of like looking bad.
Yeah, no one looks good. This is a situation where, you know, everyone looks bad. Although in some of the party's defense, you kind of have to draw a line between what's the party thinks and what individuals within the parties think. I'm not sure if we can, I don't know if these individuals, like Pat Martin, is speaking for the NDP as a whole.
Yeah, it's hard to tell because Parliament hasn't started up yet, so they don't have the kind of the cohesion that they do usually when Parliament's sitting.
Right, and this is an issue that most of the parties don't have a line on, so it's sort of an issue that they're kind of freestyling as it's coming up. But there probably haven't been a lot of backroom discussions about the issue.
But regarding David Emerson, just 5 minutes before we started recording the show, we read the CBC article about two brothers charged after manure was dumped outside of Emerson's office. So the article says, in an overnight attack, manure was smeared on the front door and the outside wall of the office in Vancouver. Office of David Emerson, that is. It was also left along the sidewalk outside the office. The words, face the voters, were spray-painted on the walls of the building. So, I mean, talk about a smear campaign in the most, like literal sense of the word. I mean, I don't know what these Jack and Ninnies were thinking. I mean, you know, I don't know. This is just not really professional, you know.
No, it's probably the furthest thing from professional that you could get.
I don't know. I mean, you know, guys, like, write a letter, okay? You know, how about this? Read a book, you know. Get literate, you know, write a letter, and then, you know, take out your frustrations through, you know...
the written word.
You know, through, you know, modern channels. I mean, you know, it's a pretty medieval way to voice your frustrations, like, short of just, like, you know, using a blunt club to, you know, beat Emerson to death, you know?
Yeah, that'd be more prehistoric times.
I know, yeah. And I guess, you know, manure is slightly more refined than, you know... the sort of the caveman with the club in that sense, you know. But on the other hand, you know, do something constructive. Start a podcast. Call it the, like, you know, the, like, I don't know. I mean, like, what's, you know, what would be a good name for that? Like,
I don't know. It has to have hillbillies in the title somewhere.
Yeah, but don't, you know, don't associate yourselves with us, you know. But how about, you know, instead of Mr. Smith goes to Washington, how about, you know, Mr. Hankey goes to Vancouver, you know.
Hi-ho, David Emerson. Face the voters.
That was horrible.
That was wonderful. Anyway,
David Emerson can face the voters, and Scott Bryson can face the ethics commissioner as far as Pat Martin of the NDP is concerned. You may recall during the election there was a fiasco that came up with allegations of insider trading. And they, at that time, they were geared at Ralph Goodale, who was the finance minister.
And, you know, a lot of people sort of felt that that was what really tipped the scales against the Liberals in the end, was that the RCMP made that announcement that they were investigating into, you know, wrongdoing regarding income trust announcements that, you know, came out right before the election. And if you're familiar with that story, basically what happened was, you know, Ralph Goodale was going to come out with an announcement regarding income trusts, and you know, about, I don't know, 3 or 4 hours before that announcement was made, there was this, you know, big peak in the stock market of trading on that. So, you know, there was a lot of allegations of there being a leak, and I think in the end, I don't know if there was any. Was there?
Yeah, as far as I understand, the RCMP investigation is still going on. So the ethics commissioner is not going to look into it because the RCMP is still investigating. But what happened too was Scott Bryson apparently had sent an email,
who, by the way, for the listeners that don't know, was the minister of the Public Works and Government Services, who was also formerly a Conservative MP, but also, you know, at, like, Melinda Swish.
Yeah, a progressive Conservative.
So anyone who didn't know. But anyway, yeah, so it came out this week.
And he's a front runner, or one of the front runners in the Liberal leadership race, which is why there's the attention on him.
And arguably is now a former front runner because of this. I've seen, you know, certain... publications that say that they think that this has, like, basically taken away his chances of running, which is basically what happened was the RCMP sat down with him this week to ask him about an email that he sent, I guess, the day...
there was a series of emails. He had an exchange with someone at CIBC.
One of his buddies, basically.
Right, and he essentially made a sort of ambiguous statement that... You know,
sort of saying that he thinks that, you know, the investors are going to be pleased with the announcement. Now, he's come out and said that, you know, he was just going on, you know, information that was publicly available at the time, that he didn't know anything in particular. He was just kind of speculating. But the big issue was that it was a sort of it was bad form, you know.
Right. And I think the situation, I mean, if you don't know anything about the stock market, it looks really bad. But I'm not really convinced that it is as bad as it seems. We know that stock markets are very intelligent. They're, you know, essentially a form of collective wisdom where you have this decentralized force of investors. They're all making decisions, and good decisions tend to, there's sort of like a built-in feedback that it just makes it a complex system. But the point being that before this announcement, they would have had to notify the media that they were making some sort of announcement. So people wouldn't necessarily know whether it was going to be good or bad, but they would have known beforehand that there was an announcement coming. Because
for later in that day.
Right, so because the camera crews have to get there, et cetera, et cetera. And so it's quite possible that the investors were acting on the presumption that this announcement was going to have something to do with income trust, because everyone was sort of expecting that anyways. And
something positive, at least, anyway, yeah.
Yeah, so, well, see, I'm not clear, did the stocks, like, I know there was a lot of movement of the stocks, but did it indicate an actual judgment as well? Like, were the stocks moving under the presumption that it was going to be good news, or were they just moving, period?
They were, I think, just moving under the presumption that, you know, Goodall's statement. So they, you know, the statement that he ultimately made was the presumption that the investors were trading on.
Right. And this reminds
me... Which is what originally kind of, like, you know, raised the flag that says, you know, hey, maybe there's something going on, you know.
Right. It kind of reminds me of, there was a situation back, you know, when the space shuttle went up and it exploded. Space Shuttle Columbia, right?
No, you mean the Challenger?
Or the Challenger, sorry.
Yeah, in 1986, I think
it was. And so what you have in this situation is they didn't know what the problem was.
I love to
was.
See where you're going with this, because okay. I, you know, the space shuttle and, like, income trusts. Okay.
All right, here it comes. They didn't know where the problem was specifically. They knew what component, you know, the problem was in. And it turned out that there were three companies that were involved in the manufacture of this component. Okay, and so nobody knew, it would take months for them to uncover which company was ultimately responsible. And so what happened, if you look at the stock, what happened to the stocks of the three companies after the crash happened, initially all three of them went down.
No, wait, no, that was the crash of the shuttle, not the crash of a market.
Right.
Right. Not
right.
To be confusing. Okay.
Okay. The three stocks of the three companies at first went down, and then what happened was the company that was ultimately responsible, their stock kept going down, and the other two went back to normal. I don't remember the names. I know it was like Lockheed Martin and a couple others. I don't even remember which one was responsible.
It's okay. We were children at the time. That's
right.
Fine.
But anyway, the point is that you have this market. They had no knowledge of what ultimately happened. Okay.
Oh,
so they were making a guess.
Right.
Right? But the idea is that if the probability of one option is even slightly higher than the probability of the others, then the stock market is going to, you know, make a really good guess. Because you have all these investors, probably a lot of the people holding the shares were workers within the companies, you know, and they themselves also didn't know for sure, you know. But the idea was that there was a slight speculation, and that speculation got magnified through, you know, this is what's essentially a chaotic system. I mean, you know a little bit about chaos theory, but I assume our viewers don't. But
well,
yeah. Anyway, it's like the butterfly effect.
Yeah.
Not quite. But anyway, the point though is that, you know, they had no foreknowledge. They didn't know for sure, and yet they made the correct guess. And so the point is, the stock market is a good way of collectively. You know, you have the collective wisdom of crowds. There's a great book. It's by James Surowiecki. It's called The Wisdom of Crowds. I recommend it, like, to anyone. I'll give you another example. We have polls, right, which make predictions about the outcome of elections. And there's also election stock markets, essentially. And they're bigger in the States than they are in Canada. There was one, I believe it was run out of the University of British Columbia in the past federal election. But they didn't have a very big pool of investors, so I'm not sure how accurate it was. But typically the American ones, I think there's one that comes out of Iowa, and they tend to be actually a lot more accurate than polls are. And they also tend to not fluctuate around as much as polls do. Like, polls go up and down. The markets tend to be more stable.
Well, could that be because... when you're sort of like putting your money down, that you sort of would maybe try to make a better decision.
Yeah.
And so you know, you're not just like some, like, armchair, like, you know, guy talking, trash, you know.
Just yeah, I think that's essentially what it is. And so if we take this back to the Scott Bryson thing, remember, these people aren't just people that are making guesses about whether it's going to be good news or bad news. They're people who are putting thousands of dollars on the line based on whether it's going to be good news or bad news. So you better believe that they're going to exploit every advantage that they have in trying to figure out what it's going to be. And they're not just making the decision on their own. They're also looking at what other investors are doing too. So, you know, I don't think it's... I'm not saying that there wasn't insider trading. There very well could have been. But I'm saying that this probably could have happened without insider trading as
right,
well.
Right, right. But in this case, they're just focused on the fact that, like, Scott basically slipped up. You know, it wasn't that he really did anything, like, you know, inherently wrong. It was just sort of, like, a little bit bad protocol. Sort of a little bit, like, you know, I don't know, you know.
It looks bad.
You let it slip that Santa Claus really doesn't exist to your kids, kind of thing. You know, you're like, well, okay, you know, technically you're not doing anything wrong, but, you know.
Well, it was probably...
That was a dumb example.
He might have done it, like, completely innocently, but it's just something that, in retrospect, given what happened, it looks bad.
Yeah.
You know, it's ambiguous. It can go one way or the other.
The question is this going to affect his bid for the Liberal leadership?
Right, and that's a very good question. I think some of it might result in the timeline when we get a report from the RCMP. I'm not sure how long that process is going to take.
Knowing the RCMP, they'll drop the bomb during the leadership, like, you know, the campaign, you know.
It could very well. You mentioned you saw a couple pieces, like, arguing that it would affect his leadership.
Yeah.
Do you remember where they were? Or?
Oh, you know, just floating around CBC and, you know, that kind of thing. So.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll see.
I think I saw an editorial
piece. I think
he
was a strong contender before. He's certainly a stronger contender than Belinda because he held a higher higher cabinet position, and he had been in the Liberal Party,
and his defection wasn't as stunning as hers.
Yeah, I actually am sort of opposed to this accusation that he crossed the floor, because it's not like he left his party and joined another party. The party that he was in ceased to exist, and then he joined another party. I think it's a bit different. Right, because if you recall, he was in the Progressive Conservative Party. They announced the merger with the Canadian Alliance, and he said, you know, I'm not joining this merged party, I'm going to join the Liberals. And
yeah, okay, well, that's just a definition argument that you could get into. I mean, I could just as easily say, well, you know, if you're working for a company and it merges and then you quit, you know, it's not like, you know, and you go and join another company, you know, it's not like your company ceased to exist. It folded into another, you know.
Right.
So, I mean, all the people are still there.
The difference, I would argue, is that in that case, you're loyal to the company. In this case, you're loyal to your political ideology. And when that merger happened, you know, his ideology was not reflected in the new Conservative Party because, you know, they moved dramatically to the right as a result of the merger. They basically went to where the Canadian Alliance was.
I
know they've moderated since, but I think initially, and of course they hadn't had, you know, a big policy conference, but they certainly ran that election closer to what the Canadian Alliance was than the last election. And you have to remember too that the Liberal Party under Paul Martin was to the right of where it was under Jean Chrétien, at least fiscally, I would argue, that it was very much to the right. And so I think, you know, you're essentially in this moderate Conservative Party, and you can either join the moderate Liberal Party or the extreme Conservative Party, and I'd say they're about equal distance from where the Progressive Conservatives were. So that's my take on it. But
right.
Anyway, Belinda. Yeah, that's a different story.
Yeah, well, we'll see what happens. So yeah, okay. Peter Cormos, he's the NDP MPP for Ontario who has drafted a private member's bill around the issue of organ donation. So as it stands, okay, right now, if you die, you get buried or you get cremated or whatever you say in your will, or whatever you've told your family you want to have happen, right? And if you want to participate in the organ donor program, then you have to sign a card and carry it with you that says, you know, I would like to donate my organs, right? So what he's proposing is that you basically reverse that. Right. So right now, it's assumed that you don't want to donate your organs unless you say otherwise. He wants to turn that around to make it so that it's assumed that you do want to donate your organs unless you carry a card saying you don't. So, and that's like causing a lot of controversy. He was on Focus Ontario Global's, you know, Sunday afternoon program. I saw him on there yesterday. Quite the animated figure. He's very in favor of first of all his bill. He's very passionate about it, and I had to laugh. He was saying, basically, he said he's at the point right now where he's thinking about getting a big tattoo on his chest that says, "In the event of death, you know, open here." You know, and so, you know, it raises the issue. Should there be implied consent? So, I mean, should it be naturally assumed that you don't have a problem about giving away your organs after you die? And his point is that when you die, your organs are now useless to you, and therefore, you shouldn't, you know, be assumed to want to keep them. So that's the big question, right? And obviously, you know, people of certain religious faiths will feel, strongly that they don't want to, you know, just give away their organs after they die. I guess the thing is that he's kind of taking the view of like, well, when you're dead, you don't need your organs, and hence, you know, you don't really have any rights when you're dead. Basically, you know, your rights as a person cease when you cease to be. But I think that the counter argument is that there's a concept called last rights, and I guess he's saying that the last rights should be respected only when they're explicitly clear and you have a card. So, you know, I don't know. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I don't really have an opinion on it. It's something I haven't really thought about, but it's an interesting debate.
So Cormus says, most people want their organs to be used, but strangely, those same people don't sign organ donor cards. So, you know, that might be true, and maybe that might not be true, so who knows. But, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting.
It's a very difficult decision for most people to make. And the thing is that, you know, a lot of people don't really, you know, they don't even have their wills put together, let alone, like an organ donor card.
Right. You know? Usually, I think when you apply for your driver's license, they ask you explicitly if you want to donate your organs. So it's a choice that everyone has to make, at least in Ontario.
No, I don't think that's the case.
Is that not true?
I think that they're proposing that be the case.
Okay, well, I think they're proposing, like, a presumption that you will donate as opposed to a presumption that you won't. But I'm pretty sure that they ask you if you're willing to donate. I know they asked me when I got my driver's license, so I don't know.
Maybe having to check either one. I don't remember, yeah.
Whatever. Anyways, yeah, it's interesting. This, of course, is coming out of the province of Ontario, but usually when these sort of rights type issues come out of the provinces, they get mimicked in other provinces and ultimately reach the federal level.
The reason why I brought it up was, for me, it was kind of like, you know, classic provincial, like Ontario NDP saying, you know, we want to decide what happens to you. You know, even in death, we're going to like have a say in what happens to you. You know, basically, we're going to just start harvesting your organs, you know. Doesn't really matter what you think because you're dead, haha, you know. And it's just that, like, for me, it was a little bit of an irritating kind of, you know, the way, it's all in the way that it's presented, you know. It's sort of like, well, you know, we're the state, we know best, and so, you know, give us your organs, you know. Rather,
but
we're going to take your organs.
They will save lives. I mean, there is another stakeholder, which are the people that are waiting for these organs.
True.
And I think it's more to empower them than to empower the state necessarily.
Sure. And, but, I mean, you know, yeah, the thing is, like, you know, one of my cousins had a heart-lung transplant, you know, so, I mean, I understand the concept of, you know, organ donation, and I understand its importance. I think that, you know, no one questions the importance of organ donation, and no one questions, I think, the need for there to be more awareness. But I'm just saying that, you know, I just think that his proposal, it's not bad, and I think that, you know, it's actually has some merits to it. It's just sort of like the ferocity, you know, basically his attitude is that people are stupid who want to keep their organs. Like, you know, he basically said everything short of saying that people are foolish for not wanting to give away their organs. Well, guess what? You know, it's none of your business whether they want to keep their organs or not, you know. So, I mean, keep your, in politics, keep your personal opinions to yourself, kind of thing. But I mean, yeah. You know, I respect that. You know, he's tabling this bill without any preconceptions about it getting through. You know, just wanting to stimulate some debate, and that's always a healthy thing. I respect that. So
yeah, and I think it will fuel debate in other provinces. Another example of sort of provincial legislation that is going to probably influence other provinces concerning rights as well is that Alberta this week passed, I don't know if they passed the bill or if they tabled it, and it was resulting with some of the personal information that is subject to the United States Patriot Act, because a lot of our companies, they're based out of the United States, and so the information that these companies gather about you is the United States government can claim that information under the Patriot Act the States.
About the personal information?
Of Canadians who, like, for example, let's say you have your banking information with CIBC, and CIBC is based in the, or they have headquarters in the States. I'm not sure the exact scenario, but the idea is that they can subpoena.
I think their headquarters are probably in Toronto, but I think, yeah, they have offices.
I think, if I remember correctly, they farm out that portion of their company to an American company. And anyway, somehow the databases are in the United States. And
yeah, it's funny because when I was in Vermont recently, I was walking around and they had like TD Canada Trust, locations, but they were called something else. There's something like Northern Banking or whatever, but it was totally TD Canada Trust. So I thought it was really funny, but like, you know, in Vermont. So
yeah. Anyway, Alberta, they're following the step of BC and they're putting forward this bill that makes it basically any company, say out of the United States, that doesn't have jurisdiction in the province of Alberta or British Columbia, they cannot acquire information that they couldn't acquire if they were based in Alberta, essentially, and they'll get fined if they do.
Say that again, only at half the speed, because, you know.
Okay, actually, what I'll read for you is what Michael Geis says. You can check out his blog. There's a link to it. A person must not willfully disclose personal information to which this act applies pursuant to a subpoena, warrant, or order issued or made by a court,
body anyway,
having no jurisdiction in Alberta to compel the production of information,
dude,
or
I'm just
pursuant
like
to a rule of court that is not binding in Alberta.
Dude, I just said, like, that, you know, like, spell it out for me a little bit more, and then what do? You go to, like, Bill 20 and, like, read the code, you know? Like, what does this mean in, like, you know, average non-legal terms, you know?
It means if you're an American company, you want information on Albertans, and you couldn't get that information using Albertan law, but you can get it using American law, such as the Patriot Act, you don't get the information.
Okay.
So Canada is essentially stepping up and saying, you know,
saying no to the Americans on, like, getting Canadian information,
right.
Yeah.
And hopefully this will get carried up to the federal level.
Right, yeah, that sounds good. And that, you know, and actually this kind of reminds me of an issue that it's kind of unrelated, but it just kind of, you know, I'm just sort of flowing here about taxes. Okay, you know, it's tax time. You know, it's tax season. Everybody's got to do their taxes, right? You know, I guess they're whatever due in April. Okay, so you can do your taxes online now, right? The CRA has an online form format for doing your taxes. So what you have to do is basically get them put into a particular type of electronic document called the .tax format. So basically what you do is you have to get a program to do this, right? Now the CRA, right, the Canadian Revenue Agency, has farmed this standard out to, I guess, third parties. So basically just, you know, software companies have, created applications, right? So you download their software, and the point is that you have to buy it. Various prices. I saw prices, you know, from like $40 for one use to, you know, $5 for five uses and stuff like that. I've seen it. You know, we were looking around yesterday on the net, and I found, like, you know, various, like, websites that offer this service, right? You have to buy their software, you know, and then you run it, and then it will say, you know, put this amount in this box, put this amount, you know, walks you through the tax filing process. And at the end, it spits out a document called the, like, you know, Jeremy's Taxes.tax. And then you take this document, it's kind of, you know, it's like a, you know, it's like a Microsoft Word document only for, you know, taxes. And then you upload it to the CRA's website and file your tax return that way. So the big issue is that some of these tax software companies, you can download their software, but some of them offer the service online. So what you do is, you know, you go to the web page, and then it'll say, you know, on the web page, you know, type your name, and then you type your name, then type how much you earned in this, type in your T4 statement. So basically, you're just giving away all your financial information to this company, and you just have to trust them not to, you know, use it or abuse it. So, you know, I was looking around on a couple of these sites, and they say in their, you know, EULA that, you know, they don't use your personal information.
But EULA, I'm thinking, being end user license agreement, that, like, big piece of legal text when you hit I agree when you install a program.
Right. So they're saying, you know, we don't use your, you know, information. But I'm thinking there probably is no legal provision that says that they can't aggregate the data and then sell it to companies that, you know, I mean, because the thing is, you know, if you've ever done a survey, you know, like the jerks that call you during dinner or whatever, and they're asking, you know, usually the last question on the survey is, what's your household income, you know? Would you, you know, and thinking about the, you know, gross household income, you know, would you say it's in the range of 0 to 20,000, 20,000 to like 30,000, you know? And, you know, this information is valuable to companies, right? Market research. So I'm thinking, like, you know, they probably have to, you know, have some motivation to want to aggregate this data and sell it off, right? So you have to kind of be suspicious of software like this. So then I started thinking, okay, well, what if, you know, a bunch of, you know, software developers, and I mean, you know, open source software developers, like a bunch of, you know, Robinhood type software developers who just wanted to, like, you know, make a application and, you know, just give the source code out, give the program out freely. What if they wanted to, you know, get together and do a project like this? Well, got talking to our old buddy Russell McCormand at digital-copyright.ca. Go check out his blog. He has lots of interesting articles about digital copyright issues. Anyways, his sort of response was that this is an ISO standard. And the funny thing about the ISO standards is that, you know, yes, they are public, except that for you to get them, you have to pay a whole whack of money. So, you know, for a bunch of just kind of, you know, sort of like mercenary type software developers to want to band together and make a program like this, it would just cost too much. And so, you know, it's never really going to happen unless, you know, we can get the .tax format. So that now, I think, makes another policy argument for the Canadian government about how it's interacting with the public on issues like this, right? We've already talked about the census. This is an ongoing issue, right? Currently, we've submitted an information request to them, and hopefully we'll get some information about how they're hosting the online census, right? This tax issue, another big issue. You know, how does the government interact with its citizens? How is it being transparent about it? Well, in this case, technically, yes, it is being transparent about it. But in actuality, no, because no average citizen knows how this, like, .tax format is. And so therefore cannot write, cannot personally author any software that's open source or get open source software to file a tax return unless they have, like, a big sum of money. So, you know, maybe we need to get together and, like, raise money to get this ISO standard so that, you know, we can develop something like this. Because I don't know about you, but I don't trust, like, you know, quicktax.ca to, like, you know, use my data responsibly. And, you know, and nor should you trust such a, you know, company, too. Because, you know,
there's always the pen and paper option, too.
Exactly. And, you know, here we are, you know, we're both tech conscious individuals, and I'm finding myself a lot of times really liking the pen and paper option just because it affords you know, privacy and security at, you know, like they say, there's no security like physical security. I mean, it's really interesting. In the online census, they use a technology called an air gap, and I mean, this is hilarious. I mean, you know, for those of you who aren't, you know, security aware, you know, in the concept of, you know, electronic security, digital security, the idea of having a physical air gap between one computer and another computer so that you want to transfer data, you actually stick in a little USB key, get all the data onto it, pull it out, walk across the room or to another room that's, like, locked down, and then stick the USB key in there. So, I mean, it seems so low tech, but honestly, that's actually a very, high security technique that's being employed, you know. But it seems so silly. So, you know, likewise, there are, you know, there is a merit to doing things pen and paper. So anyways, you know, it would be interesting to see some more initiatives like that, you know. And so definitely check out Russell's page. You know, he has a lot of great ideas on this topic. So
right.
Okay, what's next?
All right, last but not least, we have Iran.
Oh, yeah. Okay, this is kind of, okay, first of all, this is not directly a Canadian issue, but I would argue that this is a bit of a scary topic, and, you know, as far as World War III is concerned, it is a Canadian, you know, like, yeah, of Canadian interest.
Well, it's an international topic, and Canada is part of the international community, and so it's obviously something that's of relevance to Canadians.
So basically what happened, what's happened is, you know, Iran wants to pursue a nuclear program. And that's caused a lot of concerns, you know, with the international community about if they're going to be able to do it responsibly. Iran has said that they want to just have nuclear energy for, like, powering homes and stuff. Because, you know, nuclear energy is actually, you know, a pretty good power source. I think all things considered is pretty decent, you know, for what we have today. I mean, cost wise and otherwise on a national scale. So anyways, they want to develop a nuclear program, you know, for that. The problem is nobody trusts them to just stick to producing electricity. That, you know, in the process of enriching uranium, you can sort of go beyond just the regular enrichment cycle and enrich it to a weapons grade level. Which you can subsequently use to build nuclear weapons. And, you know, of course, if you don't trust the Iranian regime, like many countries don't, then, you know, you might see things like nuclear weapons getting in the hands of various, you know, unsavory terrorist organizations or whatnot. And it's just a global, like, geopolitical destabilizing force. So what happens is, or what has happened is that, you know, this is right now, it's in the Security Council. They're sitting deciding whether or not to refer to the Security Council. And, you know, it's this big world issue at the moment. And then, you know, Russia just recently stepped in and said, okay, look, you know, don't listen to the United States. You know, if they had their way, you wouldn't have any nuclear, you know, technology. We're going to help you out. We're going to make a deal whereby we'll enrich the uranium for you, and then give it to you to use for producing, energy, you know, electricity. That way, it kind of satisfies, you know, a lot of the, you know, NATO countries' concern about, you know, Iran having nuclear weapons, because, you know, if Russia's doing it, then there's, like, a little bit more accountability for what's happening, you know, how enriched the uranium's getting. They're not going to be able to, you know, as easily and covertly make nuclear weapons, right? So this was, you know, just hailed last week as, like, you know, really critical, deal.
Consensus.
Right. So what happened, I guess, yesterday was Iran came out and said, if I remember correctly, they agreed to the proposal last week. But anyways, yesterday they've come out and said, no, we don't, you know, we're not going to do it. We want to continue enriching our own uranium and, you know, screw everyone else. So now, you know, the thing is that, like, this is definitely a step in the wrong direction for the world. And, you know, it personally, you know, makes me nervous about where it's going to go from there, because, you know, if it's going to continue to escalate, then there will be a war. I don't know if it'll be a world war, but, you know, there will be some kind of military action happening, and, you know, this is just the one step in that direction. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, I think one of the critical problems of this whole situation is that we don't have anything on paper that says why Iran can't have nuclear weapons, or in general, why... Sorry, not nuclear weapons, but a nuclear program. Critical difference there. Or in general, why certain countries, you know, get nuclear technologies and certain countries don't. Okay, the closest thing that we have to it, we sort of have something like that. It's the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which was signed in, I believe, the late 60s, early 70s. There's basically three clauses. The first clause is the only country that gets to have nuclear weapons is the United States, the United Kingdom, France, China, and Russia, who were the countries that happened to have them at the time. Then they put restrictions on the methods that you can use for creating nuclear energy. And then there's further, there's another clause about, you know, disarming old stockpiles of nuclear weapons just to get the level of nuclear weapons in the world down. And so Iran signed this treaty, okay? And what Iran is saying on paper anyway is that they're going to follow the guideline of the treaty. So the treaty says, you know, what methodology they can use to develop nuclear energy. And so on paper, they have a legal right to do this. Okay, the general consensus is we don't want Iran to have nuclear technology at all, but legally they have the right to do it. Now, further complicating the matter, you
but
have...
But what does that mean, the legal right? Like, according to who?
According to the treaty. So, under... Okay. As long as they can follow the guidelines of the treaty.
According, yeah, but according to the treaty, like, I mean, it, you know, like, India is not part of the treaty, yet right. The United States just made a big deal with them, so...
Right, exactly, and that's where I was going. The other problem complicating the matter is you have countries like India... Pakistan, those are two countries that definitely have nuclear weapons. They've tested them. We've seen them test it. They didn't sign on. Israel is also suspected to maybe have nuclear weapons, but we don't know for sure.
It's one of those sort of like unconfirmed common knowledge things that, you know, Israel has the nuclear technology, technology. So,
but anyway, just last week, George W. Bush went to India, and basically, in the clause, if you're a signee of the clause, you're not allowed to help non-signee countries develop their nuclear programs. And George W. Bush worked out a deal with India where, you know, they're going to use U.S. technology in India. So that's basically in direct violation of this treaty. Now, the general consensus is that's okay. No one really cares that India has
And certainly
weapons.
From the Americans' perspective, this is sort of like, you know, big time, you know, geopolitical strategizing, long-term kind of, you know, trying to get India on board as like a long-term ally so that when, you know, issues like Iran and China and North Korea like become, you know, bigger issues that India will, you know, be on board with the United States on that. So.
Right. Yeah. But my point is that the general consensus is so out of touch with what's, you know, on paper. You know, the general consensus is Iran shouldn't have nuclear weapons. They have a legal right to it. The general conception is that it's okay for India to have nuclear weapons, and yet on paper it's they can't. And so if the gap is so big, it's time to sit back down and rewrite a new treaty that clearly outlines the criteria for countries to even have nuclear technology of any kind, not just nuclear weapons. And I also have to say that, you know, I'm not too crazy about Pakistan having nuclear weapons, but anyways.
Oh, why?
Well, it's essentially the same problem with Iran. I mean, I know they're not as extreme, but there are extremists, like, within Pakistan.
Well, yeah, I guess the big fear back during September 11th was that, or rather before September 11th was when General Musharraf took power that, you know, how long could he hold on to that power? What happens if there was, like, a radical Islamic coup that, you know, took him out of power and then all of a sudden, you know, they would have their hands on all this, like, you know, dangerous technology, the kind of stuff that would, you know, not just, like, I mean, we're not, okay, you know, we're not talking about nuclear Armageddon, but, I mean, I guarantee that, you know, any nuclear detonation that would occur in the world, no matter how small, would have a massive destabilizing force in the world and would just precipitate all this sort of, you know, I mean, economic disaster. I mean, we saw, even after September 11th, like, that I mean... For as bad as it was, I mean, that's like nothing compared to what would happen if there was a detonation of a nuclear device in a city in the world. Even after September 11th, the economy was hit, at least in North America, was suffering for a while just from that. And so, I mean, there has to just be, I mean, this is the stuff of nightmares anyway. So, I mean, you know, I really hope that the world like can come together and kind of get this issue sorted out, you know. So I'm just kind of crossing my fingers on this one, you know. So.
Right. So we'll see what happens, and
yeah,
that will about do it for this episode.
Well, no. Before we go, I want to just talk about the latest issue of McLean's.
Oh yes.
Yeah. So, anyways, you know, you're in chapters, and you know, like looking at the cover and. You know, the cover of McLean's this week is, you know, Harper's 11, you know, like Ocean's 11, right? And it's about, like, a little kind of, you know, splash about each of the top advisors in, like, Harper's, you know, circle. And so you know, I'm like looking at it. I'm like, oh, hey, you know, that's Ian Brody, you know. And, you know, I know some people that know Ian. And so I started, you know, flipping into, you know, the magazine. And, you know, so, you know, they were giving everyone, like, different names. Like, you know, the, you know, Ronna Ambrose, she's like, you know, the beauty. And then there's, like, the brain and the workhorse and stuff. And so then, you know, Ian got pegged as the enforcer. So, you know, like, it's got this picture of, you know, Ian. He's kind of got this, like, Clint Eastwood kind of, you know, like, just squinting kind of, you know, like, the stern face that, you know, kind of, like, you know, like, in full stride, like, you know, presumably down the streets of Ottawa, like, swaggering along. And I'm just thinking, you know, wow, you know, it, like, those who know Ian find it, like, have told me that they find it laughable, like, you know, the concept of him, you know, as the enforcer, you know, the stern enforcer, that, you know, any picture of him without a smile on his face has either been doctored or, like, manipulated. So, I mean, that's the media for you. What can you say? But that's why, you know, you have us to keep them honest, you know. So I guess, yeah, you know, maybe, you know, if we're lucky, you know, if Jeremy and I are lucky, one day we'll be in McLean's magazine and there'll be some goofy, you know, title, you know, like Jeremy will be like, you know, the choreographer, and I'll be the, like, you know, the whatever, you know, the groundskeeper or something like that. And you know, it'll be a fun day and we'll laugh until we cry. So anyways, everybody, that's our show for this week. We'll be back next week with more topics. And, you know, leave us, drop us a line on our blog, phbo.blogspot.com.
And our theme music, as always, is brought to us by Le Mondial.
If you dig them, check them out online at lemondial.net. Thanks, guys.
And that will about do her. So have a good week, and we'll see you next week.
Episode 4, In the Can.